ideas, they certainly hit people in the right place because the company bought them and used them. And most I can say about them is if you get an exciting idea, present it to the hilt, you know, really really show it to its dramatic best and act quickly. Otherwise, you're liable to put it off and it'll die in your mind.
Now, I'm most fascinated by the sequential rear turn signal. Previous to this, you had just simply had a flashing light. In other words, your tail light would simply flash on and off,
yeah,
indicating a turn.
Right.
But that wasn't deemed adequate in your mind.
Well, actually it was adequate. This having three lights sequentially lit one after the other in the direction which the driver intended to turn, mm-hmm, was simply a stunt, mm-hmm, to get attention, mm-hmm, in a way. Uh-huh. It did give a better indication to the driver and back, uh-huh, of what you were going to do. It got the following driver's attention too,
it symbolized,
which was good.
In the driver that was following your passenger, that you were indeed turning left or right.
Yeah, I don't think he could make any mistake in what your intentions were.
You weren't just giving a series of brake stops.
That's right. Yeah. It really showed up to that effect, and it gave a wider spread to the rear appearance of the car too.
Uh-huh. More light.
Yeah. More light, and of course it cost more,
mm-hmm,
and that meant it would be on a more expensive car. It would, in effect, say this is a more expensive car than your basic car.
What model did Ford finally adapt this to? Was it the Thunderbird?
I think it was the Thunderbird.
I think you're right.
Yeah, mm-hmm. But I had the idea they used it on a Lynx too, but I don't rightly remember.
On a
Mercury Lynx, but I'm not.
It was quite a few years later.
Yeah, quite a few years later.
But you're talking about mid to late 1950s.
Yeah, I really don't remember. As I think I said before, Ford at that time had a policy of shifting people to different jobs, trying them out at it, giving them a chance to prepare to go up a step higher in their career. In other words, if they could successfully manage different departments later on, they could be in charge of them all, let's, mm-hmm, say, as,
right,
an example.
Yes. Moving you around, getting experience in various,
yeah,
areas.
In fact, I spent some time, and I'm looking for it here now, I had an interior department for 3 years, a production Lincoln and Mercury. In other words, interior styling is not my best fort, but the belief was that you shouldn't just be an exterior or just an interior stylist, and a lot of people who were very good were. The idea was that you should be able to take care of either, and so I had 3 years as a Lincoln Mercury interior styling head. Here I am. That was from July 63 to October 64. In that time, I covered three different years of styling, though. It was not for a full 3 years,
yes,
that I was,
uh-huh,
that I had the job.
So you moved into interiors at this point.
Yeah, I did that.
Did you find this quite a different challenge, obviously, from doing exterior?
Well, yes. I had to, for example, pick fabrics,
mm-hmm,
from different fabric companies. It's somewhat like picking colors, which you had to do when you had exteriors,
yeah,
anyway.
Patterns as well.
Yeah, patterns. Weaves. You had to learn about the weaves and so forth. I had the, we did the 65 Lincoln at that time, and the product planners had accepted quite a bold concept where we were going to have the instrument panel in front of the driver in the form of a, you'll have to call it a sloping desk,
mm-hmm,
with controls on it. And we also tried to get rid of some problems that we had.
Was that a console effect?
Yeah, it was a console, mm-hmm. but it was different than things I've seen since. Mm-hmm. Not the ordinary console. Mm-hmm. For example, to get everything close to the, go back a little bit here. The engineers laying out the packaging of a car often have difficulty under the hood of the car. They will have to have meetings that sometimes last on and off for a week about what item will occupy a certain space under the hood. You'd find the electrical department fighting with the, say, the carburetor department for where they can put something.
Fighting for space.
Fighting for space. Mm-hmm. The public knows this because if you buy everything you can get on a car and open the hood up, well, you can't see through the top layer. The same thing occurs in the instrument panel of a car. If everything has to be provided for because some customers will order everything. The center line usually is a particular contention. The ashtray people want the ashtray in the middle. Otherwise, they'll have to have two ashtrays and spend more money. The radio people want their controls in the middle, and so forth and so on. In this project, we actually split the radio in half. We put a separate control head near the driver and the front seat passenger, but the radio chassis was under the seat, separate from it, with some sort of cable joining the two.
Did you know that it originally started out under the seat in the 33-40?
You know, you're right. I never thought of that. Right. So we started to move it back, but you just told me. Well, this project went along pretty well. We had gone through our shows, had designs accepted, and were pretty well down the road when suddenly we got the bad news from the legal department. We were going to get sued. It seems that a car dealer can have a competitive radio put in a car for his client. In other words, let's say he sold a car and he sold a lot of equipment on paper to a client. The client, when everything's tallied up, finds that he has ordered too much and it's going to cost too much, the total, starts backing off. The car salesman sometimes will tell him, well, I can get you a radio just like this, but cheaper. And so the cheaper radio goes in there. Now, Ford Motor doesn't like that, or didn't in the past, because when something went wrong with a radio, the client would come back to the Ford dealer and raise hob. It's like the old question of who's responsible for the tires on the car.
The radio business happened to me in 1978.
Yeah.
Exactly the way you described.
Yeah. Well, we suddenly found from the legal department that a person who was rather hated by Ford Motor Company, who produced a very cheap radio down in Long Island City, would sue the company for breach of the antitrust laws, because his radio would be unable to fit it into a Lincoln car, and apparently he wasn't about to split his radio in half. And you know, we had to start all over again and go to a more common layout and so forth, and really work on that thing to get it out in time, just because of that. But that's another factor in designing automobiles that you don't think of.
Because of threatened litigation, you had to come up with a single concept console.
Yeah, that's right. We had to, and I kind of imagine, looking back, that perhaps some of our radio engineering people might have been thinking, well, that's the way of getting the stylus off that darn thing. But it was pretty late to get us off, I'll tell you.
What model was this you were working on?
I think that was the 65 Lincoln.
Oh,
of course,
yes.
We were working on it before 65.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We also came up with a fabric that we liked and were surprised that people accepted it. This was a very smooth, silky fabric that we put on the Lincolns. We, back in the time before it was actually on a production car and had some fancy name attached to it, we called it panty cloth. It was a very smooth, nice stuff.
Nylon.
I don't remember. I'm pretty sure it was, but it had a very smooth feel, had a little grip. People really liked it, especially the stylists thought it was great. You could get in the car and slide in very nicely and so forth. Some years later, this backfired on me in a peculiar way. I was now chief designer over in England, for Ford of England, and the European manufacturers could not match that fabric. They couldn't find a fabric producer who could make it, or perhaps he'd have to tool up differently. I don't recall, but of course in the States you can do a lot more, and the fabric manufacturers there kept coming up with things that they thought would be like it, and I'd keep turning them down. I had charge of interior and exterior there, of course. Somebody came up with a fairly smooth fabric, but it had a fairly high nap to it. Well, we produced that. It was in the richer upholstery trim cars that people bought for a few years. And it caught on in America as being a foreign thing. You know, foreign things are desirable, and it became the fabric to have over here. We now find ourselves sitting on, we found American fabric manufacturers imitating the English who couldn't do the American one in the first place. that's the way it goes.
The vinyl, the material?
Yeah, but it has some nap, and actually it's getting back, I think, to the old mohair days.
Ah, yes.
Not in color. You know, in those days, I'm talking about when I first got into styling, upholstery trim, may I use a bad word here? We in the trade, we call it shit brindle. Mm-hmm. It was done as sort of a brown, nondescript pattern to it so that if you got it dirty or anything happened to it, you wouldn't see it. And of course, we've progressed a whole lot since then. We know
sort of a medium brown, is that right?
Yeah, it sure was. And it sort of dug into your fanny pretty much, too. What else can I think to say here? I eventually got back to having advanced styling. It was called the Corporate Project Studio.
Why was the name changed? Did the function change?
Yeah, for example, styling no longer was a popular word. It was
design.
Yeah. And the phrase corporate project, I believe, covered much more latitude.
Mm-hmm.
For example, we did overseas styling. By this time, we had gotten a pretty smooth process of design going, where we could turn our clay models into hollow fiberglass models with plexiglass windows and so forth very quickly, and then use the clay for reworking and making another model, perhaps quite different looking. In corporate projects, we turned out quite a few concept models that looked like real cars from a distance. They were nicely painted in fiberglass. We did tractor styling, full size. We sent our models overseas to different places if they weren't bought in America.
Mm-hmm.
Back when I had advanced styling, we used to do small-scale models we'd send overseas.
Mm-hmm.
This has an interesting offshoot here. We were doing styling for the Australians.
Mm-hmm.
And,
At long distance?
Mm-hmm. And the Australians at that time had very small tooling. They would make, say, a station wagon, and the roof would be made up of perhaps six pieces welded together and smoothed down, quite a lot of work. But we complained. I'll give you an example. At their request, via wire, we created some renderings of round tail lamps and sent them down there. Of course, it took a while for them to get there, and the person we were communicating with, it was remote. I forget whether I ever met him, because they usually couldn't afford to send their executives up to America for a very long time. But a long time later, and I'd almost forgotten about it, we got a wire saying we liked your hubcap design number 36A very much. Well, it was a tail lamp design. And somebody had ignored the red glass rendered in it, and I numbered things so we would know, and we took photographs so we would know what they were talking about. And it got pretty clumsy. That's just an example. So at that time, I was working for Bob McGuire, who was working as assistant to Jean Bourdonnais. I believe he was.
This is in the early 60s, mid-60s?
Yeah, this is... No, this is in the mid 60s.
So this, George Walker has left at this time, and Gene.
That's right. I'm sorry. Yeah, I skipped that. Okay, Gene is there, and McGuire has a good position under Gene.
Right.
He always had just gone along with Gene.
Mm-hmm.
Right. McGuire is spelt M A G U I R E.
They had come over from GM together, had they not?
They had come over together.
Yes.
And
had
always
the
swung
40s.
Together. Right. Bob. Said, well, you know, I was complaining, and he said, well, why don't you suggest it to them and make up an organization chart? And I said, I don't know what size they'll take. And we ended up making up three organization charts, you know, big, medium, and small. And some time went by, and they finally decided to go for it.
Organization chart of what?
Well, of their own styling studio. I'm sorry,
okay,
I missed
fine.
On that. This meant sending people down to Australia. They chose the cheapest way out. What they were saying, in effect, was send us one good manager who doesn't get much salary, young fella, who can do everything,
mm-hmm.
and he will have to teach a few people, a clay modeler and a draftsman, what to do and how to do it,
mm-hmm.
and we'll go from there. This was the minimum.
This is Ford of Australia.
This is Ford of Australia. So I had a very, I keep, we had a young man who was very presentable, real nice, I almost called him a kid. I had him supervising some of our models. I had three or four designers who were very good,
mm-hmm.
and would get a model going, and I'd turn it over to them. They'd supervise it, you know, and really do a good job. And this fellow's name was Jack Telnack. Have you talked to him yet?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Partially.
Well, okay. So, okay, Jack ended up down in Australia.
You tabbed him to...
yeah, we tabbed him.
To fill that spot.
McGuire was all for it. He liked Jack.
And he fitted the role.
He's got along very well with people.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack went down to Australia and founded the Australian Styling Studio, or Design Studio.
Mm-hmm.
Sometime later, in 1965, I went down to Australia on my own vacation. I'm a diver. I wanted to dive on the Great Barrier Reef.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And I took the maximum vacation I could, and Jean Bourdonnais found out about it, and said, well, hell, young Jack, he didn't call him young, but Jack Talnack's down there all by himself, and boy, he certainly needs some encouragement.
Mm-hmm.
Because Jack was writing private reports back to Gene, you know, to help him and to keep Gene in track of what was going on. He said, why don't you go over and spend, I think it was 5 days, it might have been a week, with Jack. We'll pay your expenses for those days. Well, of course, Ford got their transportation of me for free,
mm-hmm.
but I went down there, and Jack had a problem. They had given him an old drafting room in the back of an old factory. I think it was built in 1926. It had dark wood walls. He shared it with some draftsmen who had nothing to do directly with his
The old operation. Geelong, the Ford factory?
Yeah, down in Geelong.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Have you been there?
I've heard about it.
Yeah. It was at the back of the factory, and the only way he could show anything to the to his executives down there was to have it dragged outside and show it on the gravel in a little kind of a parking lot back of the building. It had some cyclone fence around it. On the other side of the cyclone fence, on two sides at least, they were a bunch of Quonset huts. At this time, the government of Australia was paying mostly East Europeans to come over to Australia. I think they were trying to prevent Australia from filling up with Japanese or other people.
Other Asians.
Asians. Mm-hmm. And they wanted the talent, more European talent, to come in there. And these people, I think, only had to pay £10 a head, something like that. Australian government brought them over, put them up in these camps, and trained them for jobs. Mm-hmm. And it was a good thing for Australia to do. I think they increased their prosperity quite a bit. But at any rate, there'd be these kids outside the cyclone fence, you know, tough urchins. They'd be climbing up the cyclone fence and hurling insults at the designers out there or the executives that were looking. When Jack modeled full size, and he found one fellow who was a woodworker who turned out to be a real good modeler, and of course he acquired more later. I remember the rear fender of his clay model was right up against a pillar, one of these pillars that's got square wood around it going up to the ceiling, next to a big draftsman's table. It was pretty hard to get a good view of things there. But Jack had to answer directly to, I'm trying to think of the name of the man who ran Ford of Australia then. Maybe we better shut that off while I... What? Jack was answering directly to the president of Ford of Australia, who was not an Australian. And he had good contact with top people, even though in a smaller area at that time. Later, when Jack was appointed head designer for Ford of Europe, somewhat later in his career, this same man was, the man was Bill Burke.
B-O-U-R-K-E?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. I was thinking it was B-U-R, but it's not. Jack succeeded the man who succeeded me as head designer at Ford in England. And Burke was over there. I believe he was president of Ford of Europe. And he, I believe, helped Jack get ahead to the position Jack has now, which is probably very well deserved, because by that time Jack had, was a very accomplished man, I thought.
Let me move you back, since we have a little time,
yeah,
back to your experiences at Ford of England. Were you one of the first to go over there from the Dearborn office to
no,
the operations there? And
we experienced somewhat the same trouble with the styling models we sent over to Germany, for example, after the war. our results weren't interpreted too well when they became automobiles. Or I should say the results of our models we sent over. I think the first man we sent over, oh dear, here I go again, missing a name. Can you turn it off again? The first man we sent over overseas was Wesley Dahlberg, D-A-H-L-B-E-R-G. Wes went over and started Ford of Germany's styling or design department, and he took a modeler with him, Fred Hoadley. I think that's spelt H-O-A-D-L-E-Y. Both of them had been in my studio prior to that. And
which studio was that?
Well, this was the corporate project studio, and I think they had been with me at other times further back in their careers. They went over and started Ford of Germany's design department. And in fact, Fred rose out of being head modeler to become Wes's administrative assistant. And I hear he really kind of ran the whole place, including the shops and so forth.
Ford of England.
This is Ford of Germany.
Oh, I'm sorry, Ford of Germany, yes.
Okay. Then, now I told you before how Roy Brown came into Ford Design through my suggestion to Gene Bourdonnais, and I forget whether we taped that or not.
Yes, we did.
Okay, good. Roy did the, Roy was the became the chief stylist of the new Edsel division, and I'm gonna divert my tale here a little bit. Roy had to come up with a new car. Really, it was a facelift of a Ford basic sheet metal, and of course he came to our advanced group to see if we had any ideas. All the studio heads could come in there and browse all they wanted to. And I had a model in there. It was a 3/8 model, made out of plaster, but painted to look as if it was real. It was one of the early Continental proposals that we did, but Continental never used. In fact, it was one we did before the Continental division was founded. That is the post-war division.
The later Mark II.
Yeah. Now, I got to go back here a little bit. It may give you an insight into the way some designers' minds work, or the way they work sometimes. You probably remember me saying that Roy and I both admired the 1938 LaSalle when it was brought into the Cadillac studio, and it had this tall, narrow, fine grille. Some years later, when I had advanced styling at Ford, I was over in the grounds of the Henry Ford Museum. At that time, we shared the same fence with a triple E building that was behind the same fence. And at lunchtime, sometimes in the summertime, we'd just wander over there, buy a couple of hot dogs, there's a little hot dog stand in there, and walk around the museum. And I can't remember the, would you call him a curator?
Yes.
In later years, we when he started putting on sport car shows in the springtime, we would loan him some of our advanced models.
Les Henry.
That was the man's name, yeah.
Leslie R. Henry.
Yeah, and in fact, Alex Tremulis worked up quite a good friendship with him. And,
did he?
After I was no longer in that, at least wasn't for a while, and I think Alex supplied him with models. But we went over in the grounds one day expecting to see something rather pleasant. We had word that Gordon Burig was going to drive the car he had made back east and tried to get some people to get going on making this American sports car, that he was going to drive it in and show it to us on the grounds there. And
what year was this?
Oh, I can't, I'm going back. You'd have to consult Gordon Burig's memoirs if you've got them or if you're going to. Gordy drove in with this rather beautiful car. It had a more of a metallic look than most cars. It had a long, slender nose to its hood, and this is where some resemblance is coming in from the LaSalle. But the hood ended up in a very narrow vertical shape with a blade, a chrome-plated blade, or a stainless steel blade, that stuck out of this slot and formed, I think it formed a rather big bumper guard in the front. Otherwise, it might have been right behind it. Well, again, I liked that very much.
It was vertical, of course.
It was vertical. It was just like, you know, running a dull knife through the air vertically at the front of the car. I liked it very much. And sometime later when I turned out a proposed Continental design, you know, just one of these ideas you come up with, I remembered these two cars, and I put a long narrow hood on this model that came to a rather narrow point, and it had a, in order to get enough cooling, we couldn't just put a narrow slot with a narrow blade, but we put a slightly wider slot in there with a sort of a double blade that came up. I've got a picture of it someplace here, but this isn't visual. At any rate, a few more years go by, Roy comes in the studio, is there anything I can supply you with for your problem? He had to really get going and get something out. Well, he said yes. He said, I've always liked that model there, that green one with a wicker on the side. And I said, well, I've always liked it too. You know, that'd be great, Roy.
You'd kept it all these years, then?
Yeah, it had been there. Well, you didn't throw things like that away. Yeah. You didn't let anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And so he we had the model. He borrowed the model, had it shipped into his studio, And of course, he had ended up fattening that basic idea until it became the often referred to toilet seat on the front of the Edsel. And that's the way these things generate over the years.
He simply took a vertical device and simply elongated it into an ovoid.
Well, if you turn that off, I think I can find the a picture of it. The this particular model was a 3/8 model, and it had a tall, rather narrow vertical opening at the front of the hood that extended from the very top down to the hard frame around it, which went down in front of the horizontal bumper bar. So in effect, it was a rather giant bumper guard that rose up from the bumper and was suspended freely in this narrow slot of an opening. Roy liked that, I'm quite sure, and I did too, and he used it for the Edsel, but he had to make it lower and wider, and the concept really changed then. I think Roy did a very good job with what he had, but he may have wished that he could have gotten off that particular type of design when he was halfway through and probably couldn't get off. It was too late. It's a case of where a design sometimes will look very good when it's done one way, and when it's done another way, it won't be any good at all. Another example of that is a Studebaker car, a post-war Studebaker car, looked very good as a two-door, but when they did the same thing with a four-door sedan, it didn't look good at all. It just, it's one of those things. And you get going on those tracks, and sometimes you can't get off. You have to go ahead. But that's my story about the Edsel. You'd probably have to ask Roy Brown what actually happened to it. Getting back to having the corporate project studio from which Jack Talnack and some other people graduated. Let's see, it was, Roy went over and became chief designer for Ford of England.
Now, was this in any manner means an exile?
I don't think so, really.
Was it widely interpreted at the time?
Yeah, it probably was, but actually Roy was a very good man. And
you'd already established a pattern of moving people to England and Australia.
Yeah, and he, those companies needed somebody that could handle the whole story, the whole thing.
Right.
And I'd say Roy was a very qualified man. And I think Wes was in Germany for some 9 years, and I forget how long Roy was there. Roy was there an awfully long time.
I guess the length of his stay contributed to that legend that it was an exile.
Probably, yeah. But
the Edsel had failed.
Yeah, but they, in other words, because the Edsel was out, they had a good man there, and they needed a good man in another position, and Roy went over. I went over. We turned out many models. We would send quite a few fiberglass models over to Germany, over to England, and we sent one model over out of my studio. I can't remember, we gave them all names, but it might have had the name Capri, but we sent it over to England, and were quite amazed when the English wanted to make this car.
Capri had previously been used on the non-continental Lincoln, had it not?
Yes, yeah, but this one we called the Capri in the studio. It was a fiberglass model, it was red. Went over to England, and somebody in England, it was an American, rather fell in love with it. There was an opening in the English market for a rather sporty car, which also could serve as a sedan, somewhat the way there was an opening in the market in America that was filled by the Mustang some years before. And they wanted to get going on the Capri, and I ended up being sent over there to design it. I was back in a production job now. I'll make the story short. We turned out the Capri, That was a very amazing car design because it turned out so much like the concept model. It was one of those things that just went very smoothly.
You had sent over the pre-concept.
Yeah, we had a full-size dummy car made out of fiberglass, plexiglass windows, and so forth. The only change we had to make was rather late in the program. They were tooling up for it, and people in the company were a bit worried about the rear three-quarter view. That is, when the driver turns around and tries to look out the rear quarter window to see where he's backing into, say, into a parking place, parallel parking. And we took one handmade car and changed that rear quarter window shape. It had been a D-shaped window, like the letter D. We found we had to cut a better opening. We showed it to a chosen part of the public, and the public liked the better visibility.
Research.
Yeah. Oh, no, we ended up with a D-shaped window, where before we had had a window, a rear quarter window, whose bottom opening swept up. We had a molding along the bottom of the side windows, top of the doors, that as it came aft, it swept uphill and went over the back end of the roof and down the other side. And the window followed that line, and it blocked the person from looking downward to the rear and sideways. So we quickly put a D-shaped window in there, and that was one accepted. But that was the only variation, really, from the original concept model.
Now, what year was the Capri introduced?
No, I'm trying to think.
1970s?
Well, that would have been, went over there in early 67.
Okay.
I think it came out in 70.
Was it built in England or was it built in Germany?
They started to build it in England. The English at that time had a bad reputation for the quality of their work.
The final assembly.
Because of they had so many unions and so many strikes. And the Germans did a better job. And so it was decided to tap the big market, that is, U.S., where even relatively small sales would be very big to a European corporation. They decided to tap the U.S. market with a German car. And I remember I had to spend a weekend remodeling the front end on a wood die block because we had to put four headlamps in instead of the two that were on the European models. And we quickly got that done, and the Germans were producing the car for America. While in England, I did a few other cars. I can't remember their names right now. Maybe I'm getting tired.
The Capri was a relatively limited import model at first, but it became extremely popular in this country.
Yeah, it started selling better, and as I say, it looked small in sales here. But to a European, that was pretty big.
It was exported through the Lincoln Mercury division.
Yes, yeah. And then later on, it was adapted for American production, and the name was picked up.
The first time it came over here, it came through from Germany as a German import, Ford German import,
yeah,
through the Lincoln Mercury division.
Yeah. Okay. If I went over the some of the other English cars I did, I'd have to look them up. I was back in England about 3 years ago, and I went around taking pictures of these cars because I don't have any record of them, and of course I was finding them on used car lots by this time, so I more or less lost interest in them. I would say this, that I had once in a while have to pick up a car part at a junkyard. We have a very big one south of Vero Beach, and when I go in there to look for parts, I almost feel like crying because I
see,
I see these terrible wrecks, and I think of how proud we used to be of these designs when we were clay modeling them. It's just it's devastating, terrible.
Well, at this point, you're sort of a concept man for Ford of England or Ford of Europe, is it?
Yeah. Well, no, not really. I was chief designer there.
Oh, okay.
I was running the whole thing.
But that's what I meant by concept.
Yeah. In fact, I really had to run it because there was no director over me.
Mm-hmm.
I think almost a year later, Damon Woods was sent over, but later on he was killed in an accident.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was alone by myself again. That is, I was doing my function and my boss's function. And then Joe Aris came over.
Yes.
And I got out of there in...
Did he replace you?
Eventually. I spent, I think, 3.5 years there, mm-hmm. which had become sort of the normal stint for yes. Changing around. Right. And I came back to the States. I by this time, I was working for Don Della Rosa. And
in what department?
They gave me a research studio.
Uh-huh.
I had...
Advanced the studio again?
Yeah. It had different names. It was somewhat bigger. I forgot to tell you, I had volunteered many years before, back in 1955, to handle automotive safety, which was an unpopular subject then.
But the government was pushing for it.
Well, not really, but Ford was doing crash tests and so forth, and I wouldn't be surprised if they were the first ones doing it. But I went to Gene and said, why don't we have a styling effort that handles this? And mm-hmm. he didn't like the idea. Everybody else thought it was, you know, it's kind of an ugly subject.
Yes.
And I said, well, you know, someday some politician's going to come along and make this a real something. And I think we ought to have control, even today, of what these things are going to look like,
mm-hmm.
Rather than have people rejecting them because they're ugly.
Right.
And this is back when I had, forget whether I had the Ford Studio or Advanced Styling, but we did a collapsible steering wheel,
mm-hmm.
which would collapse and save a person from being impaled on the steering post.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to have collapsible steering posts then, but that was way off.
Huh? Telescoping?
Telescoping. This was way off. It had a lot of experimentation had to be done with it, a lot of testing. And we came up with this collapsible steering wheel. And I believe the man was a dentist. At least he was intoxicated. He ran into a railroad overpass abutment, the concrete. And this wheel saved his life, but it broke a rib.
Mm-hmm.
It collapsed, and he decelerated at the proper deceleration
rate.
There
was no seatbelt.
I don't remember whether he had. We had seat belts then.
This is after the 56 safety pack.
This is back then.
Because you had a wheel that a steering wheel that was deep dished.
That's right. We had vertical spokes in it.
But you had no collapsible steering gear at that time.
No, it was a collapsible steering wheel.
But not a telescoping not steering
shaft.
Column.
No, we didn't have that.
Okay.
That was we wanted it, but it was off in the distant future.
Right, yeah.
But the man, it saved his life,
mm-hmm.
but it broke a rib or two, and he sued Ford Motor Company because we knew it was going to be unsafe. That's why we provided the safety gadget, and he won his case. And I think it was Henry Ford, that is the second Henry Ford, who. Vetoed. It could have been somebody else, but vetoed some of our other projects after that because it was... For fear of litigation. If we made the car safe, why, we're acknowledging it wasn't safe, so to speak. But
seems ludicrous today, but it was very real.
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was trying to remember, how did I get on that subject?
Safety packages.
Yeah, safety packages. Well, we had some other interesting things show up in Ford of Europe. I know how I got on that.
I'm not sure that steering columns telescope today, do they?
Yes, they do.
They do?
Yeah, almost all, I'm sure.
Okay, on impact.
Yeah, on impact.
Okay.
They will compress and absorb energy when they're doing so.
Okay.
And the driver's position for head-on collision is pretty safe.
Mm-hmm.
It actually is the airbag, so to speak,
yeah.
for the driver. The reason I got onto that, it was that when I returned to the States, I also got automotive safety. Whenever I had advanced styling, I also had automotive safety because nobody else wanted it, and it was a general subject rather than Mercury or Ford division thing.
You returned about 72?
Yeah, 71, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, 71. And so my studio there, a good deal of it, we put in a giant street intersection to show some of the aspects of visibility. We were into visibility then. And I also had to have, was my idea to have great big full-size charts, really they look like the back ends or the front ends of cars, showing all the limitations in all the different countries of the world and the different states as to where things had to be. So many governments now had rules about safety that it got very confusing.
State governments.
Yeah, and we would invite engineering groups to come in there and meet with other engineering groups and discuss these things. It was the only way to make it visible to them and find out why they were conflicting with each other. And we also had government people come down from Washington and meet in there so they could have something visible to talk over. But we did some safety cars there, and we did a few other advanced models. And
you were working with dummies, of course, in crash tests.
Oh, yes, yeah. And we or I or both would suggest ideas to our engineering opposites who would perhaps make up something to test. It was very interesting. I had one that I had someone told me a couple of years ago that Ford still might consider it instead of airbags. It was a big drawer that would come out and absorb your energy as you were thrown forward in the so-called death seat. And of course, it also served as the as a glove compartment. But I started to tell you a while ago that the instrument panel is a very crowded area, and I'm sure there are some conflicts there. But he said it would be cheaper than the airbag, and might see it again. But I rather doubt it. I think something else will intervene.
That's where they've got the airbag today in the glove compartment, is it not?
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. After I returned, I went down to Argentina a few times. The Argentine Ford Company had bought the old, what was a small car Ford made?
Falcon?
Yeah, the old 62, 63 Falcon tooling, even the engine tooling. Mm-hmm. They wanted somebody down there with European experience to facelift that old car. This was for 1973, to facelift it so it looked like a European car, mm-hmm. which sells better in Argentina. And I guess the thing was a success. But I found out some of the problems that Jack Talnek was against. To show my model, I would have to get a man in with a sledgehammer and bang some of the sheet metal in on a real car and then fill it in differently with clay. And I had to take moldings and use them both right side up and upside down to achieve a grill because they couldn't afford to make two different moldings. And to show it, I had to have somebody go out and drive it in circles in front of an executive committee outside so they could see all sides of it.
This is Ford of Argentina you're working
on. Yeah, this was my suggestion to replace the fact that they didn't have a turntable to rotate the thing in front of them.
Well, apparently it succeeded because that became the favorite vehicle for the Argentine police, did it not?
Yeah, it became a good seller too. At that time in Argentina, and it's probably true today, what do they call it, the fall in the value of money, the inflation, mm-hmm. so bad that an engineering employee there would have to negotiate his salary with his boss every 6 months. I'm not kidding. Mm-hmm. It's a full-time effort. But a person would invest in a good car, just like they would invest in a house in the United States, mm-hmm. and the value of that car would go up and the value of the money would go down. Mm-hmm. And a good car that could take it and stay in good shape. And the Argentines reinforced these cars just as the Australians did because they had rougher roads to run on. I understand they made a good car out of that. I don't think it was just the styling, but it apparently was a very good seller for a number of years.
Mm-hmm. Your basic redo of the early 60s Falcon.
Yeah, and I had to facelift this thing by myself. With people who didn't understand me and I didn't understand them. It was quite interesting. We had to improvise a lot. For example, I went down there Easter time, and the Easter holiday is just like Labor Day in the U.S. Mm-hmm. Summer ends, everybody comes back into town, vacations are over. And I found out later that the plant manager, I was put up in the engine plant, given a little room. And the The manager of the plant didn't like that at all, so he tried to freeze me out. I didn't realize what was going on. Mm-hmm. And he turned off the heat ducts that come into this, came into this room. And I had some of the men working for me build me a great big plywood box, and they put a whole lot of, must have been 24 flood lamps in that, and aim it at my back so I could stay warm enough to work. But that's the type of thing that went on there. Getting back to the United States, I had come back from Ford of Europe, and I found myself with a research studio. We handled problems with safety pretty well, but our design concepts didn't seem to be going anyplace. I think they were rather coming from Ghia in Italy by this time. There was a somewhat of a lack of communications from up above, and I at one time was told rather abruptly that it only looks good if it looks like a Mercedes. And about this time I started thinking of retirement. To me, cars had become more or less wheelboxes, which is a sliding term we used to use for them. And I couldn't see any call for originality or designing beautiful lines anymore. To me, the era that I worked in was coming to an end. And I started thinking of getting out. You asked me how I felt about this near the end of my automotive design career. I didn't feel I was needed. I did not feel comfortable with, say, succeeding with a design because I had more successfully copied a competitive car than somebody else. That didn't appeal to me. I didn't feel that shapes mattered so much anymore. Things were getting rather square. And so I didn't feel bad about getting out of it, and there was this lack of communication from up above. You'd do something, and perhaps no one would pay any attention to it. There was, I think, the communication had been cut off from up above. I could probably give you some examples, but I don't know if I want to tape them of what went on. While I had this corporate project studio along with automotive safety, we did work with some interesting things. At this time, Ford was getting interested in a people mover, and I had one engineer working for me. I'm sorry, I forget his name. Ford had inherited him from Philco. His specialty actually, I think, was radio reception, that is, antennas. But he was good at electricity, and we built a little model that ran around on tracks of the concept of the people mover, and Ford used that, the people mover that now runs around Fairlane.
Mm-hmm. The Fairlane...
Has automatic switching, and we worked that out in a little bit of a model. We worked on some interesting projects that
way. Was John Najar involved with that Fairlane project?
He was later.
Later.
But
he took your...
That's right. Coming up with this little model was mostly this electrical engineer's, how it would work.
Mm-hmm.
I had quite a bit to do with the switching methods. And
who designed the actual car?
The actual shape of the car was not done by me. It was done in, I think they used to call it the Industrial Design Studio, and Johnny Najar has probably had that at that time.
He had it at that time.
Yeah, and so it's not my story.
Mm-hmm. But you did come up with the switching concepts.
Yeah. I had started to tell you a while ago that quite frequently I got odd people working for me. I don't mean people who were odd, but people who perhaps had a specialty that had no niche in the regular organizations. There was another engineer who worked for me, and again, I'm sorry I missed on this, but He had a computer terminal and worked on vision from cars. Mm-hmm. And he went at it from a very, very scientific standpoint. For example, he worked out a rear view mirror. Now, a rear view mirror inside a car has some blind spots. And using a computer, he came up with a mirror which was split vertically down the middle, and part of it moved aft about a half an inch. And it gave you the same visibility you normally would have, but it eliminated the pillar that was in the way. This was another person that worked for me. I think Gordon Burig was with me twice, some years before that, the end of my career. And again, after I came back from Europe, Gordy at the time was working on new plastics for car bodies, the type of thing that was being used in fighter planes that has millions of coils of wire in it. He later went from there to the research department to really work it out. He also, at that time, in his own spare time, was working on the T-roof that General Motors used. And he had an agreement somewhat like McPherson to carry on with this thing and as his own rather than as Ford's. And I think if you've interviewed him, you've found that that's been successful.
However, but, he did not receive any royalties.
Yeah, I know it. Yes. I hope McPherson got royalties on his. But I might say after Gordon had been over at research for quite a long time, I happened to go over there to pick up my son one day, and I saw Gordon standing on the curb in front of the building. And I said, you know, what are you doing, Gordy? And I just retired, he said. And so I picked him up and drove him home in Dearborn. And he showed me a cord he had recently acquired, you know, a classic.
One that he'd worked on back in the
Well, yeah, that he had designed, and he had found one in good condition. Mm-hmm. But I had a few other people, I can't recall who they were, from, way, way back, including some designers who were, or engineers who were very big on perhaps one subject. In the early days, we had a man who had designed a car where it had interchangeable front and rear doors from side to side, mm-hmm. and some other scheme where you could put a two-door under a four-door roof and so forth. He was very hepped on this, and he worked for me for about a year. I really didn't do anything. He just, you know, got along with the guy and encouraged him and helped him show it. This thing didn't particularly work, but
good concept, though.
Yeah, that's why we often had some of these odd jobs that would come out of the advanced areas that I had.
So at this point,
well, I retired in 1974. I found that I did not like what the things I would have to do. We had not been high livers at home, and had I think invested well, particularly with Ford Motor Company's retirement and investment plans. And so, when the Depression of 1974 came along and the company offered early retirement, I took full advantage of it and got out of what I was then calling the rat race. We're talking now about some concept models that were made back into the early 1950s. These models are 3/8 scale models. The industry had the standard policy of making quarter scale models up until post-war times, when they found that they'd rather go to 3/8, because the scale difference between a quarter-scale model and a full-scale car was too much. Moldings would come out looking too big if you enlarged them to the same scale effect. For example, this one I'm looking at now is a 3/8 scale model of a that we call the Muroc.
After the racing compound in
yeah, it,
the United States.
What we have is a a car that has a blister over each wheel, much like the high-speed cars that raced on the desert near Muroc years ago, but it has a passenger car top on it. It can carry four people. And incidentally, this model had a rotating it had rotating front seats, so that when you open the door, the seat would rotate at right angles, and you could sit down into the car and then turn. Chrysler actually picked this scheme up and worked with it, except they had a I think they had a sort of a round marshmallow shape that could rotate.
Was the Muroc your most successful concept car of that period? Was there one or two others?
It was. It got quite a bit of publicity. It had a very bright cherry red lower body and a black shiny top. Yes.
One more, perhaps, very quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
That caught your fancy, besides the Muroc.
Well, there's this model, also 3/8 done some years later, called the Cavalier, the one we loaned to the
Edsel Division
or studio.
Special products.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which that actually was a just another proposal for a Continental car.
Mm-hmm. It turned out to be the Roy Braun used it as the Edsel front end concept.